Hey, this is Lawrence with a quick introduction. This is the first we're doing in a series where we're going to revisit every Resident Evil film. These movies meant a lot to us in high school, and we're kind of going through and do they hold up? Is there anything we see in them now that we didn't then? And what is the fact that we liked them so well when we were in high school and college say about us? This is a re-recording. We had originally recorded the first one like a year ago, but it was lost to just horrendous audio quality issues. So I got everyone in to do a re-record because I didn't want to give up on the whole series idea. And before we recorded the first time, I had the fellas answer which is the best Resident Evil, which is the worst Resident Evil, and what's the weirdest thing you remember happening in a Resident Evil movie. Unfortunately, I can't find Ronald's answers, but I do have Brandon and Rahul and mine, which you will hear now. So this is Lawrence just giving you my brief thoughts on the Resident Evil series. First question, which of these movies do you think is the best and why? Obviously, they kind of all have blurred together in my head, especially since there are a bunch of them in this series that I haven't seen in like 10, 15 years. I think it's 3 or 4 where they're in the Las Vegas desert and Alice has psychic powers and there's all this like dumb shit with like crows and stuff that the series finds is like really agreeable, sort of just, I am stupid as fuck and I'm going to have absurd things in me. That is the thing that I like best about the Resident Evil. The one I think is the worst, I'm going to go either... I remember the second to last one with like this fake city and all these like clones of people who had died in the previous films being pretty bad, although I can't really remember why. Aside from that, I think the first one is probably going to kind of suck because that's the one that's closest to being a good movie or like a normal movie. Not egregiously stupid, and that's not really what I'm looking for in the series, so I don't think I'm going to like it. And my memory of this craziest and stupidest thing in the series? So remember this motorcycle stunt in Resident Evil 2 where she just kind of jumps through like a stained glass window in a church with no apparent way of knowing what was on the other side to save some people at the climax of a fight scene? That always stuck me as just like, you're doing something cool without thinking through whether it would work. And then I think that the fellas are going to end up arguing with me on this, and I might be wrong, but I am convinced that at the end of Resident Evil 6, at the beginning of Resident Evil 7, they show you images that are designed to make you think that Albert Wesker, noted tentacle man and sunglass enthusiast, has become the President of the United States. So President Wesker. Or a stupid motorcycle jump. Those, I think, are the two stupidest things in the series.
Let's see. Of the Resident Evil movies I remember, and I've seen all of them, I think that the first one, in my opinion, is the best as a movie. I think it did a lot of fresh and interesting things that the later sequels just sort of rode on. Also, I just really like the idea of invading like an underground lair. I don't know. I feel like the later sequels just got progressively more and more detached from reality. That's what I'm trying to say. Next question is, which do I think is the worst and why? I honestly don't really remember the differences between the movies. I remember like bits and pieces of like ridiculous scenes, but there was one movie where they brought back all these old characters in like a simulation or something. I'd say that movie was the worst because I just feel like that's a really, lame and weak storytelling device to resurrect your dead characters just to make a movie. And yeah, that's also maybe not the craziest thing in the series, but probably the stupidest, in my opinion. I mean, pretty much everything Umbrella does is pretty unbelievably stupid. There are a lot of stupid things, but, you know, I'll put that at number one. Something else that was also really stupid was, I don't know why this bothers me so much, but Alice has like this clone army. And she just, like, sacrificed them like they're worthless, like, all over the place. That always bothered me. Anyway, that's my answer for the three.
So I think the best movie is the first one. I think that it's relatively the simplest And there's, for the most part, there's actual tension throughout the entire movie from them not knowing what happened inside the hive, opening the doors, getting down to the queen, disabling that, and having to fight their way out, and everything that happens throughout. I think that's actually, there's actually a lot of tension there. It has a lot of iconic moments, the laser grid hallway, the T-virus Dobermans, the, you know, introducing the exposed brain dog things, the floating people waking up in the whatever, the cells of water. I think the plot itself is a little bit weak with Alice and her fake husband and selling information to some journalists, and that's all a little bit weird. But overall, yeah, I think I like that one the most. I really like the music for that one. I think the worst is probably, I don't know if I actually remember what movies happened beyond this one, so maybe they get even worse later, but the last movie I remember is the underwater lab where they're simulating outbreak scenarios in major cities. And that one obviously has a lot going on, and a lot against it, in my opinion. So first of all, that's like the farthest from, in the timeline, from Resident Evil 1. So it's the least plausible for how this giant facility would still be running. And they're like cloning people as well as keeping a bunch of T-virus infected people active and alive. And well, okay, the T-virus people, they don't need to keep alive, but the clones they're keeping alive. They also introduce characters from the Resident Evil 4 game, unless I'm mistaken, and they were introduced in a previous game or something, but Ada Wong and Leon, which is kind of annoying because I kind of would have rather them just make a Resident Evil 4 movie. I think Wesker also shows back up in this, and he's kind of like fun, I guess, but it's also kind of silly that, like, because his particular T virus mutation slash infection means that this is the Matrix now. So yeah, I think that overall is the worst one for me. The most things that bother me. Also, it has to do with my runner up for worst moment in the series. So my actual sort of craziest, stupidest thing in the series. I might be misremembering how this all comes about and how it's enacted, so maybe this isn't going to be as bad, but the satellite mind control that they implement in, I think, the third movie, where, again, I also might be misremembering this, but I think that's also the first time that Alice in that movie is a clone that then is released into the world. And so I think I remember that they were experimenting with, like, changing her DNA, basically trying to replicate the original Alice and yada yada yada, and so they introduce some sort of way to mind control her. So sometime in the middle of the movie, when they're having this big fight in the desert, I think they're in Las Vegas at that point, and they release a like a container of T-virus people. Then in the middle of the fight, they push a button, activate satellite, and Alice just kind of stands there and does nothing. She puts her guns away and she's like put to sleep, basically. And like, I don't remember them saying exactly how that works, other than probably just some sort of hand wavy bioengineering. Like, I don't think they had a microchip or anything, and they probably used some ridiculous term like they're locking onto her biofrequency or whatever. And then also she just kind of fights it and wakes up, and then she's fine. And then I think it's not relevant the whole rest of the movie. I think that later during the climactic fight scene with the doctor guy that mutates himself, I think that's all like psionic battling. I don't think it's like the same mind control mechanic. So that's just kind of weird and annoying, and that's, it kind of stands out a little bit to me compared to all the rest of the T virus things that they do. I will say though that a close runner up was, I was thinking about this, and the movie that takes place in a prison, which I think is the next one, four, there's a sort of Pyramid Head knockoff guy that has a weapon, a giant weapon that's like a half axe, half mace kind of improvised thing, which is pretty cool. But also, like, where did he get that? I think in the Sim City movie later, Alice and Ada Wong have to together fight two of these guys, and I think they come back with the same weapons. I could be wrong about that, but if they do, that's fucking ridiculous.
My name is Lawrence Allen.
I'm Ronald Shaw.
I'm Rahul Vora.
And this is Bad Time Radio.
Welcome to a very special episode of Bad Time Radio. This is the first episode of a new series we're starting where we go through the Resident Evil series of films. Although in a bit of a twist, we're actually re-recording an episode we recorded last year that was lost to audio issues. But I didn't want to just give up on the whole thing because I really like the idea of us revisiting these films. So this is a bit of a re-record. And I don't know, if especially Ronald sounds especially dispirited because he had to watch a movie he didn't care for twice in one year. that's what's up. And we have with us our friend Brandon, who... like us, sort of not grew up with these films, but watched them a lot in high school.
He's our resident Resident Evil expert.
Yeah, and let's just go around and like, what's you guys' sort of like experience of this movie, or like these series of films? Brandon, why don't you want to start us off?
Sure. So I think I probably watched like the first four, or maybe just the first three. A lot in like high school and college. And overall, the first one's definitely my favorite, but the other ones have their moments, you know? And then I remember like one of the last ones we went to, I think at the Dollar Theater in Albuquerque, maybe. And we just like, were talking through it the whole time, like making fun of it, which is great. But, yeah.
Yeah. For me, so I believe I was introduced to this by Rahul just sort of coming over with a DVD that I am sure he acquired legally, even if it did have a label written on it in Sharpie, and insisting that we watch. I think we actually started with the second one, which is good because I don't know if I would have stuck with the series if we'd watched the first one first. And then we watched these a fair amount because they are very appealing to teenagers because they are stupid in a way that you can laugh at, but also contain a lot of stuff that would make a teenager go, whoa, that's cool. So pretty great movies for teenage boys to watch. And I think I ended up seeing, I don't know, I think I saw 3, 4, and 6 in theaters. I remember we made a big deal out of going to see the last one in theaters. And the last one starts with Mila Jovovich and Paul W.S. Anderson coming out and seeming faintly puzzled, but thanking everyone for supporting these films so much. And I think we actually like applauded when they did that. Yeah. Wow. So it's a series that I have a lot of like fondness for because we watched it so much in high school while being under no pretenses whatsoever that it is good. I'm not one of those weirdo film critics who are like, look, if you look past the fact that the story is stupid and the action is poorly edited, there's a lot, you know, there's actually really good filmmaking in here. No, this is fun trash. Ronald?
I will admit that I don't think I got as into these as you guys did. I watched for sure the first and the second ones in theaters. And I don't really think I watched it that much until I started hanging out with you guys again in college. And Rahul was constantly talking about Resident Evil for some reason. So I think I revisited the films. And then I remember going to the final film at the Dolly Theater, or whichever one that was. Remember going to doing that with you guys. That was really fun. I don't know if it holds the same place in my heart. I definitely think I'm like kind of the opposite of Lawrence, where it's like I think the first one and the second one are pretty good, and then after that they get really bad. I'm not really looking forward to watching it, but I guess we'll see. Maybe my tastes have changed or something. I'm not sure.
But I would like to clarify. I do not think any of these movies are good. I think that after part two, they get so incredibly stupid and pile so many stupid things on top of each other that they are very funny to watch.
Oh, absolutely. I totally get what you mean. But I just mean in terms of entertainment value, not even necessarily in goodness. I found the first two the best. But we'll see, because I haven't watched any of past the two in such a long time. I really don't remember them that well. Maybe they're really funny in retrospect. After watching the first one again, I kind of have my doubts, because it made me think of the parts in the other movies. So I guess we'll see. Yeah, that's my experience with the Resident Evil movies. I enjoy watching it with you guys. I don't think I would watch, like, if it was on TV, I think I would probably change the channel.
Wow, you won't even sit there and passively absorb it. Devastating.
Probably not. Yeah.
Okay, and Rahul, I guess you're probably the one of us who likes these the best, based on sort of our testimony that you're patient zero for this whole thing.
Oh, yeah, you know, I don't remember that doing that DVD thing at all, but
sounds like
I
you.
Did have a number of DVDs that we watched extremely often that were all legal.
Yeah. It was Resident Evil, Resident Evil 2, and Terminator 3 were sort of the big Rahul movies.
Well, I saw Resident Evil for one first at Brandon's place, and it was super scary. And I was like hiding. I was running back.
Yeah, like one of my pastimes in high school was making Rahul watch scary movies. I also introduced him to Saw, and that was the best.
I don't remember that, but I can imagine blocked it being out. Terrible.
I remember that night you showed him Saw and then showed him The Fugitive. It was a very strange programming choice.
Yeah, but anyway, you know, like Lawrence was talking about, thinking some moments are so cool. For some reason, the idea of a hive is just so cool to me. I mean, it's so stupid, but anyway, it's so cool to me. And then, like, in the second movie, it's like there's, like, two things I like about these movies. There's, like, one thing I like about each movie, and it just sticks with me. Well, that's not true for the first two movies. Like, when the nemesis is just, like, blasting through his ammo, it's really stupid. It's so stupid. But I'm like, you know, as a teenager, I'm like, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. You know? It's like this Warhammer 40K trailer, like way back in the day, when there's like this robot and it's just like all this spent ammo is just like jetting out of it. Do you remember this, Lauren?
It's a dreadnought, you fucking idiot. It's not a robot at all. He's talking about the Dawn of War trailer, and he should be very embarrassed.
So cool.
I'm actually surprised you remember that.
Yeah, you know, like some robot Warhammer thing.
Right, or it's like in Terminator 3 when he like targets, he like tries to not kill anyone with a minigun.
So if you're trying to make a movie that Rahul at least will see, you need to have someone firing an enormous gun very quickly, and you need to really focus on the ammo casings falling for some reason.
I don't know why that's my thing, but that really gets me.
Yeah.
There are worse things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know where we ended up on whatever we were supposed to talk about, but
what was your turn about you on again?
Yeah. So let's go around and would you recommend this movie before we get into summaries and stuff? I'm gonna start. I think that paradoxically for this zombie movie, it is very good until around the, or not good, but entertaining and surprisingly well made until the zombies show up. And then it gets super boring somehow because, like, they just can't figure out a good way of doing an action sequence around any of the zombies or monsters that exist in this world. So aside from, like, two good-ish scenes, after the 50-minute point, this thing is incredibly, like, not just boring, but somehow, like, tiring to watch. Like, I felt very enervated after I'd seen it. So if I were you, I would watch the first 50 minutes and then, you know, you're watching it, but every time you get bored, just hit plus 30 seconds on your remote and you probably won't have missed that much, honestly, unless you see two people talking. If there's two people talking, watch that scene because often they will say something very funny. Not intentionally, but still. Brandon, I think you're our number one Resident Evil defender. So what did you think of this?
I mean, I think Raul is going to defend it, maybe not in the same way, but I would definitely recommend this. I broadly feel the same way that the movie's a lot better before the zombies show up. That's definitely the better half of the movie or a third of the movie. I don't think they really like get any of the action sequences to feel like intense or I don't know if I want to say believable, but like, I don't know. It doesn't feel like there's any energy in them in a weird way. And yeah, they also kind of, I feel like they do some of the explanation of the backstory in a weird way as well. So it just gets weird, but overall it's still very entertaining. So I would recommend it.
And Rahul, as our, other Resident Evil like defender, I guess.
You know, every time I watch it, I feel like it's worse, weirdly, but I still recommend it. Just because it's so critical to movie history.
This is the first time zombies and nu metal met. You gotta witness it.
Yeah, you know, it's like, I feel like this movie relied a lot on cheap tricks with the zombies to, like, make them work. You know, like, somebody will be up against a cage or, like, a grill, and then zombie hands will come out, and there'll be a little sound associated with that.
Yeah, I was like, how did you not notice that?
I know. And then, like, suddenly zombies are there, and they're struggling with the balance, right? I can tell that, like, you can't make mobs of zombies powerful in this scenario without the entire party getting wiped. So what do? You know,
you wipe the party.
Yeah. we'll get to this later. There is a very key structural error in this movie that stop means that they can't really do the thing you do to make the zombies feel menacing of having them kill a lot of people.
Yeah. Also, I feel like Michelle, I said this the first time and I still strongly believe this, Michelle Rodriguez, in my opinion, was the best character in this movie. I felt like she had a lot of character, like Alice, and the bad guy. They really had to rely on the fact that they didn't have their memories to be interesting at all. Otherwise, they just wouldn't have worked as characters.
Yeah,
like Michelle Rodriguez and the dude who died,
hacker guy,
laser.
Oh yeah, the captain.
Laser Captain.
He's pretty cool too.
Like, yeah, those two characters, like, I felt like had substance, that you could like hang a movie off of them.
I kind of like the cowardly hacker guy.
He was good too. He was definitely good, but I don't feel like he could drive the movie. He was a backup dude, still good, but you know.
Yeah, I feel like he was a good supporting character.
Yeah,
and finally, Ronald, what did you think of this?
You know, I hate to be a hater.
No, you don't. You love that shit.
I will say, the when I watched this last year, the first 30 minutes, I was like, oh my god, I forget how fucking good this movie is. It fucking rules. Like, the intro is so cool. And just, like, the whole mystery of the hive and, like, the setup of everything is really, really awesome. So if you haven't seen it, I would say it's easily worth it just to watch it for that. But, you know, I'm just mirroring what everyone else is saying. Once it gets to zombies, it's just a very boring movie. I think one big fatal flaw that we haven't talked too much about is that Alice being able to do, like, supernatural moves for some reason, it really takes away a lot of the tension from the movie. She just feels, like, super overpowered and for no good reason. And so it's just kind of like, in the other movies that's more explored, it's like, oh, Alice is like this crazy godlike figure. So I guess that's more the premise of the movie. In this movie, it just kind of feels like, what? Why can't she do that? And I guess she's like some kind of super agent, but also maybe some kind of T-virus enhanced person. I don't even know.
I guess it's supposed to like wow the teenage viewers, you know, for the first time.
That there could be a pretty girl who kicked ass.
This is what I think happened, okay? Paul W.S. Anderson was into Mila Jovovich while he was filming the movie, and he changed the script to make her like look cooler because he was like, God, Mila Jovovich is so hot. Maybe if I make her have a lot of scenes and look really cool in the movie, she'll be into me.
You know,
I think that worked.
Oh yeah, they did get married. So married.
So you know, good for him. But it, I think it just made like the movie really weird. If that's what happened,
you know, Ronald. Okay, does the fact that this man actually found a way of using the like film to pick up Mila Jovovich, doesn't that kind of justify every artistic decision he made in these movies?
It justifies it in the sense that it did. He did what was right for him, but He didn't do what was right for me, Lawrence.
When will people start thinking about Ronald?
I mean, she could have had a slow burn, you know? Like, in the beginning, she struggles against the dogs. And by the end, she's regained her memory somewhat, and she's able to fight. Yeah. She didn't need to just start off being able to one-shot all the zombie dogs.
I just don't really even see the point of making her that strong. It just, I don't think it adds anything to the movie. I think it's just weird and feels out of place and takes away all the tension from the movie.
I was kind of thinking about that. Like, maybe they're trying to be consistent with the video games or something.
Alice isn't in the video games.
She's not in the video games, and none of the characters are supernatural in the video games. They're all just like regular people.
Until I think the guy in Resident Evil 7 and 8 turns out to be supernatural.
Okay, fair enough. I haven't played those ones, but definitely in like the first four, everyone are just like cops.
In the first four, you're just some dude with a shotgun being sent to battle first zombies and then inscrutable Europeans.
So I don't know, man. I don't know what happened with this movie. I would love to see like some more behind the scenes, if like maybe I could read up on that. I also think I guess I'll just get into this later, but I just want to mention there's a lot of random references to like Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass that just have nothing to do with the movie. And it's like, I think this is like common in the era. Like, people really loved to reference Alice in Wonderland at the time or something. And I think that was just reflected here, but not for any like anything deeper than just the surface level stuff, which is very confusing.
Yeah. Anyways, you guys want to roll for the summary?
Yeah, but sure. Go ahead and leave me out, because I watched it a year ago, and this time I kind of half spaced out through the second half of it.
Okay, I'm going to do 1, 2 is me, 3, 4 is Rahul, who I may accidentally call the Neanderthal because he still hasn't changed his display name, and 5, 6 will be Brandon. It's Rahul. Okay.
Right. Oh, perfect.
Okay, I'm going to give a countdown and then start the timer and everyone mute except for Rahul. So 3, 2, 1, mute.
All right. The movie opens with Alice, who just wakes up in a house. She's lost her memory. It's a creepy old house. She's like running through it, trying to figure it out. Someone grabs her. She panics. And then a bunch of like marine type people bust in. They explain that they're like operatives, blah, blah, blah. They need to like break into this underground installation. So they go there, they pop it open. It's been locked down by this robotic intelligence called the Red Queen. They start going in, and it's like all this creepy shit, this burbling zombie looking shit. They make it to their idea is to go in and see what happened. And they need to reboot the Red Queen. So they get to a lot of people die on the way in a laser chamber, which is a Red Queen defense. They reboot the Red Queen, which releases all the zombies in the place. And then pretty much the rest of it is just them running away from zombies and killing them, and Alice slowly regaining her memories. And there's a little reveal at the very end that Alice actually was in cahoots with the dude who initially scared her at the house for exposing Umbrella as an evil corporation, and that her cover husband actually was the one who snuck into the facility and released the virus. And that was the big twist. That's it.
Wow, you finished almost perfectly on time, aside from I'll point out that there's a stinger where Alice gets the other guy who's helping her take Umbrella, they find out he's infected with the T-virus, so they take him away. Oscar, or I did this last time, Jason Isaacs, not Oscar Isaacs, takes him away to be in the Nemesis program and just takes Alice away for studying. And then she wakes up dressed pretty similar to how she was in the Fifth Element and breaks out of the facility she's in, walks out, and discovers that there's a newspaper that says the Dead Walk. And the city she is in has been like destroyed. Like, there's all these wrecked cars and everything. And there is a really cool pullout where you just keep seeing more and more and more of the city devastated as the shot gets further and further away from her. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, let's get into some high points. So I'm going to start, which is there is a sequence at the start of this where the T-virus is being released. So the Red Queen is dealing with that by killing everyone. And it is just It's very funny. She like drowns some people. She gasses some people. For some reason, she does this extended sight gag or gag where she traps some people in an elevator, makes them think that they can escape. So one of them crawls out, almost severs the woman's head who's trying to crawl out, but is sort of stuck halfway through his head by lowering the elevator. And then for some reason, just yanks the elevator up to sever her head the other way. And it doesn't really
way of killing people.
Yeah, it doesn't really make sense with what we know about the Red Queen. But in terms of just like a weird, fucked up, slightly horrifying, slightly funny like gag, it's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. The whole starting sequence, I'll add, just is a really, really awesome start. I feel like it adds like a ton of ambiance to the movie. Just like it makes it feel like, I don't know, kind of mysterious but dark, and definitely like just sets the tone correctly, I think.
Yeah. Brandon, what's your high point, or do you have some?
I was trying to think of something that isn't going to overlap with other people, but honestly, I probably have to say the laser hallway scene.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was really good. And also like that was what, like the most badass moment for the captain guy.
Oh man. He's such a cool character.
When he got sliced up.
Well, no, when he did the front lever up to the ceiling to avoid the laser, like with all his gear and stuff on, just like, yeah. And then he's like, okay, I got this, I can dodge it. And then it fucking goes to a grid and he's like, oh,
well,
fuck.
Yeah, that one,
backed up.
That one moment of him just realizing what's going to happen before he dies and the look on his face, pretty good. Yep. That scene's also weird because it's the only case I know of where the movie adaptation ended up influencing the video game, because something very similar to that happens to Leon in Resident Evil 4 that they've said is a direct homage to this sequence.
Oh, cool.
That is cool.
It also leads into another like a funny part where they shut that down immediately after it passes through and kills him, and then the doors open, and then Kaplan's like, okay, let's go. Like, he's fucking crazy.
He's like, I just shut down their defenses. And he's like, you literally just said that.
Yeah. Already said that.
That was,
why another, would I trust that?
That was another cheap moment, because he goes down the hall, picks up the device, and then they scare the viewer because Alice like grabs him on the shoulder. And it's like, is that what you would have done? You wouldn't have been like, hey, let me help you.
Yeah, and like that bugged me too, because they have a shot where they show Alice and the other amnesia guy sitting leaning against a wall, like they're like, I'm not fucking going down there. Kaplan goes down there by himself, gets like halfway down to where the bag is, and he's like super nervous all the time. And then Alice touches him on the shoulder and like, hey, calm down. And then she like goes with him. It's like, if you were so calm, why weren't you just going with him to begin with?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep. I think that's a great point. Alice's character throughout this is like, what is your character? Are you like a total badass, or are you lost on where you are and you don't know what's going on? And I don't know. I guess maybe the idea is that the flashes of her memory are what drives her to being a badass, or, but it's like, maybe she wasn't that good of a person, whatever. I don't know.
It's, I will say, so Mila Jovovich in general, you know, not super good in this movie. Like, a lot of her line reads are a little bit flat, and also they don't really give her a consistent character to play, so there's not much she can do. She does get better throughout the series, I think, or at least they get a better sense of Alice as just this unkillable badass who should be always confident. But the sequence where we first meet her and they wordlessly establish that she has like doesn't have her memory and doesn't really know where she is, I thought was pretty good, like physical acting.
Yeah.
And also you get to see her nipple briefly. We argued about this last time. I went frame by frame. It happens when she's putting the robe on. It's totally there. Mr. Skin did not lie to me.
I saw it too. And I've never seen it before until,
You went through frame by frame.
I've seen everything.
Yeah, you've already seen everything.
Yeah, you're ready to die now.
Well, I'm glad you checked that out. You know, it's really important.
Yeah.
So speaking of Alice, let's pivot to Michelle Rodriguez. I don't know her name in the movie, but
doesn't fucking matter.
I thought she was awesome. Rain. She was so good, and it all came together for her as a character when she'd been bitten multiple times, and she's like hanging over a bunch of zombies, and she's dripping her blood onto them. So good, so good. What a great character.
There's this weird running. I can't tell if it's intentional or not, but in most movies, you know, a person will get bitten by a zombie once and then, you know, hide it and slowly turn. She gets bitten by a zombie, I think, every time she meets a group of zombies. It's this really weird running gag where she just, it's sort of like in for a penny, in for a pound. Yeah. I can't get any more infected. Might as well stick my hands out there.
I mean, to be fair, I think the first two or three times was before they knew that there was an infection.
Yeah, that is probably true.
Yeah, like, the first whatever, one you get bit, for who sure. cares? Yeah.
But even the second one where she like just sticks her arm into the whole group to save that other guy, they hadn't talked to the Red Queen about the virus yet.
Still, it's just funny to me that for some reason, you know, she keeps getting fucking bitten by zombies.
Actually, there was another good scene with the zombies. They're trapped in a room and zombies are coming in from every side.
You're not really helping me tell which scene that is. That's like half the fucking
You'll
movie.
You'll figure
dude.
It out. My God. All right. So they're trapped in a room. Zombies are coming in. It's at the beginning. And they're trying to open a door and they finally figure out the code and they enter it. And there are a bunch of zombies on the other side of the door. And I didn't think this was a cheap scene at all. They immediately grab the guy who opened the door.
I laughed pretty hard at that, although I don't know if I was supposed to or not.
Probably not, but yeah, I felt like that was like one of the non-cheap examples of zombies.
Yeah, because it could really could. Yeah. Although it'd be pretty stupid if you're in a facility full of zombies, when you're about to open a door that you don't know what's on the other side, to turn around and be like, "Well, that was easy."
I also kind of question why that one door it wasn't opened when the Red Queen said that cutting main power would open all the doors.
Maybe she was back by then.
Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't fucking matter. I've been trying to do this less of like poking holes in the logic of movies, because unless the movie like really invites it, it's a lot usually better for everyone's enjoyment if you just get on its wavelength, you know.
Instead of being like the doors should have a passive lock. What the fuck is this stupid facility?
Why would everything unlock when the power goes out?
Jurassic Park shit. Like,
if they're developing like the most lethal bioweapons the world has ever known in this ultra secret facility, maybe there should be a backup generator.
And also, maybe you shouldn't put the air conditioner that goes to the entire building in the lab the most dangerous
airborne virus that ever. One. There was not facilities money for that. It was requested. Yeah.
They spent it all on digging out a giant facility underground instead of just renting a building.
My question on this is, okay, do we think that Raccoon City existed and then they dug the hive underneath it, or they dug the hive and then built Raccoon City on top of it? Either is stupid, but I'm curious which one you guys think it is.
I don't know.
Okay, but I was also paying attention this time, and they said that the hive was a facility that was built to like be the secure facility for researching, and there was 500 people who worked there, and they also lived underground. For some reason. And that's why they have a secret entrance like at that mansion, which doesn't really seem like a great place to have an entrance to a giant underground facility. Because I was thinking like, okay, 500 people work at this place. It's not going to be secret. Like people are going to say like, hey, I'm off to work. And then
they shoot down an elevator. It was supposed to be a secret, which is why I was so confused about the whole mansion in the first place. I was like, what's the point of hiding your secondary entrance?
But the primary entrance is still in the middle of the city.
Yeah.
And clearly they're doing like, right? It really seems like this should just be in the middle of nowhere. But the real reason the mansion is there is to reference the first game. And the real reason it's under the city is because that's what happens in the second one. So you just have to blame the Japanese for this one.
And it's also called Looking Glass Mansion. Ooh.
Oh, yeah.
Looking Glass.
How did you know that? Where does it say that?
It's labeled in one part of the movie.
So another high point for me on this is James Purifoy is in this. I mostly don't like him because he was in that Solomon Kane movie, which I think does violence to the character of Solomon Kane. Nevertheless, he has two very excellent scenes. The first, there's zombies coming. He's standing next to a door. This other guy comes up and he's like, oh, you waited for me? And James Purifoy just deadpans, I didn't know the code. Which is funny.
It was then, really good. He's like super chill. Everyone's panicking. I didn't know the code.
Yeah. And then the second scene is where he just gets his memories back. Up until this point, he's appeared to be a reasonably good dude, maybe. Ambiguous, but not like a super sociopath evil guy. And then the second he gets his memories back, he's like, oh, right, I'm a bad guy, and starts cackling and monologuing and shit.
And basically, you know, condemns everyone else to die.
Yeah, he apparently was willing to kill like 300 people to be with Alice. And then the second she's like, I don't want to be with you, he's like, fine, I'm over it, and moves on, you know, which is unbelievable in two ways. One, he committed that many murders, so it seems like he should be obsessed with her. And two, if he's willing to commit that many murders, it seems like he should try to take her with him against her will, you know?
Yeah.
Not that, yeah. I'm glad that like it didn't go that route, because that's gross.
But if he's not, if he's like barely that into her, then why did he even bother doing this in the first place?
Yeah. Also, his logic does not, to me, make that much sense, because he heard her saying, I want to take down Umbrella. And in his mind, he interpreted that as, I should steal the T-virus and sell it for money.
And also kill everyone in the facility.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Six and one half dozen of the other.
Brandon, do you have any more high points?
Or any low points you want to explore?
Yeah, if not, we can transition to low points, but I thought I'd give you a crack.
No, not specifically anything else.
Okay, let's go on to some low points then. Oh, wait, one more high point for me. The Red Queen is one of the few times in this. It's a very effective melding of performance, because they got a creepy little girl, and then special effect because they use CGI on her. And although the CGI in this mostly looks like dog shit because it was 2002, and there were like two people in the world who knew how to do good CGI back then, the fact that she looks bad actually works in this case, because she's supposed to be a really eerie hologram. And there's this one scene where she's trying to convince them to kill Michelle Rodriguez because Michelle Rodriguez is infected, and she's just shouting in her little girl voice like, she must die, over and over. And it's really like tense and affecting and cool.
Yeah, actually, speaking of that, I kind of like even better the part when you first meet her, and she's trying to basically begging them to not turn her off, but she just says like, "Please, please." It's kind of like 2001: A Space Odyssey, where it's like kind of this deadpan effect, but they're ignoring her, and then like right before she shuts down, she's like, you're all going to die down here. Which the voice actor is pretty terrible for the Red Queen, but
she, I don't know,
it kind of works okay.
She doesn't have to be good, though, is the thing, because she's playing a robot. She's so the worse, the worse she is, the better she is, weirdly, you know?
I think in those small lines, it's totally fine. I think there are some parts where she's clearly reading something off the page and stumbles over it, which... it's like, oh, that's a little girl trying to read like somebody who wrote a bunch of nerd shit on a page. You know what I mean?
It is a bold move to give about half the exposition in your movie to a preteen girl.
That's not an actor.
Yeah.
I think she's like, what is she? The daughter of like one of the producers or something? I can't remember.
I don't know. In later movies, she's literally played by Mila Jovovich and Paul W.S. Anderson's daughter. But I don't think she is here because they hadn't been together yet. Yeah.
Yeah, the problem that I had with the scene that you were talking about, Lawrence, where she's saying like, kill her now, is that it's so weird, because compared to how she acted when they're in her like server room and she's always like calm, and even when they're going to shut her down, she's just like, please, please. Then she's like freaking like bloodthirsty, wanting them to kill her. And it's like, I don't see why she should care either way, like whether they kill her and get to escape or whether she just kills all of them in the hive. Like, I don't know why she's getting all excited. It just confuses me every time.
Yeah, but I think that on its own, of that little girl voice just shouting killer is pretty, you know, freaky. How's that?
I get
even
that.
If it doesn't really work in the overall movie. Yeah. Anyways.
That's a lot of this movie. A lot of it is like pretty interesting on its own, but then it's like when you think about it in the context of the movie, you're like, why did that happen again?
Yeah.
It makes no sense.
Anyways, let's get to some lower funny points. So my first one is, so everyone in this mercenary team has just like God killer assault rifles, right? You know, or these weird like submachine guns with like scopes that are almost as big as they are, you know, real like Matrix, like 90s and early 2000s shit. Except for this one guy who for some reason just has a pretty small revolver. And I was just trying to figure
out. Computer guy.
Yeah, he's a computer guy, yeah.
Yeah, we can't trust a computer guy with a you know, assault rifle. It'll break his nerd arms.
Have you seen World War Z?
Oh, yeah. It immediately kills himself.
Such a good scene.
Oh, yeah. It's not expected.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, and at one point, James Purifoy is complaining about the Red Queen foiling his plans. And he is an Englishman. And he does, his American accent really comes and goes. It kind of floats around, like, what region he might be from. So he goes, that bitch of a computer. Like, computer. Not saying the R. Like, he's briefly from Boston.
Nice.
It's like he almost slipped into his own accent, and then he, like, emergency trying to avert to American. It just sounds really weird.
Yeah. Anyways, come on. Let's do some more.
Let's see here.
Here's a question for you. When the Red Queen, okay, so they were all trapped in that room. James Purifoy had just turned evil. Why didn't the Red Queen just gas them all?
I think she's out of gas.
She's out of gas.
She had enough gas to kill everyone.
The fucking underground facility, like.
There's only so much. There's
only so much gas, emergency. Man. All right, she could have drowned him.
No, she's out of water, too. All she's got left is a whole bunch of rooms.
All right.
You know, if we're talking about why the Red Queen did stuff, why didn't she just tell them right away, hey, before you come in here, there's zombies.
Yeah.
And that's why I killed everyone. Probably go get a containment unit or something. You know, like, what did she think was going to happen? Eventually, people were going to keep coming in and investigating if she just, like, tried to murder everyone as they came in.
That was my question about, like, why did she gas the mansion?
Yeah, but like, not with killer gas for some reason.
She ran out of the killer gas.
She's like, I ran out of killer gas. I'm switching to the backup amnesia gas.
Why did they even give me this gas? This isn't helpful.
I wonder if somebody's going to come. Since she was tracking the dude, James Purifoy, if she knew he was on the train and she couldn't get to him, so she had to do like the mansion things, and they don't have like separate circuits for that. So it just, if you gas the train tunnel, you just gas everything.
it's like this was horribly designed, but all right, we just gotta turn it off.
Working with what I got here.
They cut up to Raccoon City and the entire city's just being gassed.
They're just like, what happened?
Wait, what replaced the deadly gas? Was she continuously pumping good air back in?
Rahul, why? This movie has fucking zombies.
You could have just left it filled with killer gas.
The T-virus counteracts it.
There's a central air system that's like pumping air through it. So,
I mean, you know, later it consumes all the water on Earth, so it was probably consuming that Elon.
Why not take the tranquilizer? Amnesia gas. Okay, there's another part with the Red Queen where James Purifoy is evil, right? And he leaves everyone to die, and he goes out the door alone and to take the antidote. And then they're like, oh man, I can't believe he's gonna get away with it. And the Red Queen's like, actually, I don't think so. I've been a bad girl. And then she like lets the liquor out on him, I guess. But then it's like, so you won't let Michelle Rodriguez out infected, but you'll let the liquor out?
Yeah, that makes so much sense.
That's so much worse. That thing is so dangerous. And anytime it touches anything, it completely mutates it into the fucking nemesis. Like, I don't even know what you're possibly thinking. James Purifoy wasn't infected. I mean, barely was, but he was taking the antidote. So it's
the
like,
programmer for the AI accidentally did an order by ID descending, where the ID was lethality. Common mistake.
Trade out somebody who's not infected and probably won't destroy the world for the fucking liquor.
I don't want to piss on this too much, but I do think the fact that James Purifoy was going to sell the T-virus to people probably means that she shouldn't let him out. Because that's a pretty big risk, too.
I mean, fair enough.
Umbrella was going to sell it.
Yeah, so yeah. She should declare. I do think she actually does declare war on Umbrella in the last one. And also, I think in the last one.
Spoilers! Oh my God!
But I want to say this so that you guys just keep in mind what the fuck, like, what this movie could possibly mean in the context of what the series turns out to be about. It turns out the Umbrella Corporation was planning on releasing, or possibly this was their plan for, like, this is how they released the T-Virus, so that clones of all of the board members could take over the world after the T-Virus had killed everything, and Alice is one of those clones. It's like, what the fuck? How does that mesh with this weird sort of self-contained story about a woman going into a hive, you know?
You know, that sounds insane, but I'll bet that
but she was also working.
We have a couple billionaires who'd be totally down with that plan.
I thought you were going to say, but I'll bet they justify it over the proceedings five or six movies. I forget which.
Dude, okay. Well, she's working with the revolutionary group to take Umbrella down.
I guess the cloning process doesn't work good. They're not loyal. Clones aren't loyal, as the saying goes.
These clones ain't loyal.
Anyways,
I was gonna say that the end when they fight the big bad Licker, it was kind of weird how the Licker just showed up after they'd been riding on the train for a bit.
Well, like, I'll just interject really quick here. When they zoom out to see the train, it's going about 5 miles an hour.
Like, oh, really? Oh, it seemed faster to me.
Well, when she held it down onto the tracks when they kill it, it seems like they're going like 50 miles an hour or something really fast so that it dies by friction. But then when you zoom out and see the train, it's like moving really slow.
It's like a carnival ride train.
It's like that. I think it'd be faster to walk.
All right. Fair enough.
Yeah, I want to say, so the Licker is kind of a big point of issue with this movie. It's supposed to be sort of the ultimate like bad of the film, or the like big monster that they defeat at the climax. The CGI for it is, of course, laughable, but you can't get too hung up on that because, again, it was 2002. But the thing that frustrates me about it is that you will occasionally see a Licker puppet, and it appears that the Licker puppet was actually quite good, although it's hard to tell because they're cutting around it, which could just be that Paul W.S. Anderson really, really, really loves cutting around things, as you'll see in this movie. But it could also be that the puppet was bad and he was hiding it. But I do wish that they'd tried more with the puppet. And second, they defeat the Licker in the final, like, it being on the train, like, within about... what, 30 seconds? I mean, they figure out the bullets don't work, so they stab it with some pipes and then dump it out of the cargo doors that don't work like any other cargo doors I've ever seen.
I mean, it one-shots one dude, scratches spiky hair guy, but yeah, they defeat it probably in a minute.
Yeah, it's far too easy for, like, the final boss. There should be, like, multiple scenes. Like, if the Licker's going to be the final, like, bad of the film, there should be at least another scene where the Licker comes at them and they can't stop it and they have to run away from it, you know?
Yeah.
I think it was a product of it being too expensive to show. That's my theory on that. Because, like,
they could have used intelligence to defeat it rather than, you know.
And, I mean,
like,
they knew how to push the button. That's smart.
She trapped it over the trapdoors and then opened the trapdoors.
The cargo doors, Ronald. They're the cargo doors. I don't know why, because that doesn't...
There is no cargo hold below the subway car, but...
It wasn't trapped. No, it just stood
there. It also
there.
Opens, it opens up. Pierced. It's on the floor where people would be standing, and it opens up directly into the tracks.
Into the tracks, which have an electrified rail, so that anyone who touches it will die.
I don't see how that's not trapdoor.
Lawrence over here arguing against himself.
And then the other thing is, well, no, I'm not arguing against it being a trapdoor. I'm arguing that they call it a cargo door, so it must somehow, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, be a cargo door. But anyway, it also, you can just open it by pushing a single button while the train is moving. This may be the single most unsafe thing in the movie that also has a key virus.
It's a very large button, too. Well,
and it just gets pushed by having Michelle Rodriguez get basically, like, shot into it. So she basically just, like, leans on it and it opens and kills the thing.
Hopefully it's not a full train.
Surely that wouldn't normally happen.
Yeah, I mean, famously on a train, you do tend to like get jostled and like shake around a little bit as it hits corners and speeds up and stuff. So, yeah, this, everyone in the hive was going to die from this cargo door.
Although this is a resident, this is a umbrella corporation built train, I believe.
So you're saying so that they
kind of has to be like dangerous to all its occupants. You know,
that the umbrella corporate charter says that everything they build has to have a death trap in it somehow.
You know, it's umbrella, like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. As soon as anyone gets hurt in it, they're like, I want him in the train wheel.
It's like you load a bunch of boxes in your train and you use the cargo door and they just was it supposed to do that or because we loaded it through the side, dude, like why did it fall through the bottom?
Why aren't the cargo doors the things on the side that we put cargo in?
The train's just fucking jammed.
And also all the stuff is catching on fire because it's touching the electrified rail.
It's just, you know, that's the price you pay when you have cargo.
Train. Yeah. Oh, also, the Red Queen appears to have been right about everything. Yeah. She was right about what would happen if the people went into the hive. She was right, basically right about what would happen if they shut her down, because basically everyone does die. And they try to make her sound like she's, you know, evil for wanting them to kill Michelle Rodriguez. But it turns out that she's right, and Michelle Rodriguez was too far gone for the antidote to work, and killing her would have been the right call and made fighting the liquor very slightly easier.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, she was, like, not incorrect because she had more information. It's just that she probably should have told everyone else the information so that they could understand why she was doing what she's doing instead of just lasering people to death.
Do you think if she hadn't killed the people who were infected with the T-virus, that they would have turned into monsters?
That is a good question. I was kind of wondering, is the T-virus still in the air?
I guess not, because they walk around without gas masks.
Yeah, somebody explains that it's like it can be transferred through every form, but
it is protein in nature.
Yeah, but it's no longer in the air, I guess. So
it's switched over to blood-based transmission, which is significantly worse.
But was it like, I mean, is Lawrence right where like they were infected in the air and they just like had to die first?
Yeah.
I mean, they were definitely infected because that's why she had to kill them. And then they came back as zombies. But my question...
I'm into the agents, people like Alice and the rest of the group.
I mean, the two people who survived do end up turning into monsters, but...
Right. And everyone else...
We'll never know.
Yeah, we'll never know, I guess. But, like, I think basically they all turned into zombies and they were all infected.
There was a scene when they walk down the laser hallway again, right? And they're like, where are the bodies? Didn't that happen? Or
yeah. And I guess the implication is that the pieces of them are now zombified and walking away.
I mean, yeah, where could the captain have gone? Like, seriously.
Yeah.
What was that, Brandon?
Where would the captain have gone? He's in little, like, one-inch cubes.
He's just a pile of ooze.
That's actually pretty dangerous
in terms of T-virus. I wouldn't want to be around it.
Yeah. That hallway sequence is really cool, but also it's sort of a problem in the movie because they kill, like, conservatively 4/5 of the mercenary team doing it, which means that they can't then establish the zombies as threats by having the zombies, like, consistently, like, killing people. So I think that they should have doubled the size of the team, I guess, so there'd be more cannon fodder for the zombies.
Could have had two teams, maybe. I mean, that's not unreasonable.
Yeah, he's like, Alpha team, go down the hallway. Oh, shit. Okay, Beta team, go fight
Alpha
the zombies.
Team,
oh,
Alpha
shit.
Team, go reset the Red Queen. Beta team will go
find Gamma team.
Venom, antivirus.
Actually, you know what? The whole movie should have just been a StarCraft game where it's somebody just sending troops in and slaughtered by the Red Queen. And zombies and various other threats.
No, the whole movie should have been a StarCraft game where two Russian men throw watermelons at each other.
No, I think the whole movie should have just been 90 minutes where instead I just played StarCraft.
Oh, yeah. That would have been a much better use of time.
Oh, well.
Yeah, something else that happened with the hallway scene was Alice and the dude, spiky hair, like run back totally implausibly, and it doesn't make any sense. You know what I'm talking about? Like, they run back, and they're like, I think it was the hallway, and they have to be reunited with the remnants of the original team, but they made it through like hordes of zombies. And they have to, like,
close the door shut
against hordes of zombies. It doesn't make any sense.
I mean, that, like, starting with... So, like, they first meet zombies in the quote-unquote dining hall where they're actually housing all the liquor pods. And they shot the Red Queen, so it releases zombies. So that's where they, like, first encounter them. Then, when they have that scene where they open the locked door, the guy gets sucked in, and then they narrowly escape and they start running away. It's just, like, it just cuts to... Alice and the other, like, fake cop guy are just, like, walking by themselves for a long time, and they wander around. And it's like, how did they get separated? How are they, like, alone and away from zombies for so long? And then how did they get back to the Red Queen room, like you're saying, through zombies somehow without getting scratched when they don't have any weapons?
Didn't they get separated when a liquor pod exploded and it, like, I don't know why that.
I mean, a liquor pod did explode, but I didn't think they were separated then. I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure. That I think that was just the event prior to them being separated, but it doesn't explain how they could have been separated by that.
That was the part of the movie where I was just spacing out, because it's like a bunch of contrived stuff, and it was kind of less interesting. I don't know. I couldn't follow that part either.
Yep.
I do like Umbrella Corporation keeping the liquor pods around, though. It seems like a really useful.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like something weird. You got to look into it.
Yeah. You gotta house 1,000 of them.
Yeah. All right, put that in the storage pods. We'll figure it out later.
Look, we got the storage pods from Costco. They only sell 10.
We could probably give it to the military. I don't know.
We'll right. Yeah.
The most dangerous possible.
It's like, it's a storage pod, but if you want, it could also be a bomb. It's great. It's called dual use technology.
It needs a constant power source.
And now you're like, it's
not thick enough to hold what's inside of it.
And it is not bulletproof. And I know you're thinking, okay, it needs constant power. So obviously we're going to put backup power. No, that costs money. We're not doing it.
Wait, it did have backup power because the light switched to red.
You know what? Fuck you, Rahul.
It has backup power for the light, but it doesn't have backup power.
It's got a 30-second battery.
You got to have the light on so people know that the liquor might get out and can stop it.
You know what else is weird is that I'm pretty sure there was a scene when they started shooting all the zombies and they were like shooting the pods and, you know, I think someone says something about being concerned about shooting it because it's like gas is coming out of it. But I'm pretty sure there's one where they cut to one of the lights turning from green to red because it's being like shot and depressurized or whatever. But it's like, shouldn't they have all already been red because power is still off? I don't know.
I don't know.
That is a good point.
At that point, was power back on or...
I'm not sure.
I mean, I'm not sure what quote unquote power means for every single system. I thought that they were still off, but... I don't know.
Yeah. I don't think that Paul W.S. Anderson really.
We have questions.
Well, that's how you know it's great art, because it provokes questions it does not answer.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if this is like a nitpick or if this qualifies as a low point. But the other thing that bothers me every time, too, is at the very end when they get to the mansion and they're talking and his arm starts to like transform and the hazmat people come in and the guy's like, you know, I want him in the Nemesis program. Then he also says, you know, call whoever, we're going to get the team together and we're going to go into the hive. I want to find out what happened. Just do it. And it's like, he says like Nemesis program. He knows what's happening to this guy. He's like mutating from the T virus. So he knows that he's going to find a bunch of zombies down there. Like, and then that obviously leads to Raccoon City being totally ransacked by zombies. So that was obviously a mistake. So why the fuck did he do that? Like, what did he hope to learn from that?
What did we learn here today?
Curiosity, I guess. He already knew, but he had to verify.
Then how is that curiosity?
Okay, here's the thing. Maybe the Nemesis program was something totally different.
Totally unrelated.
Yeah.
Total mistake. It's just a coincidence that he thought that this applied.
Yeah, right. And then when they got over there, they're like, dude, why did you send us this guy? What the fuck?
Why is this guy turning into a weird zombie covered in pipes who keeps looking for chain guns?
And he's like, I don't know, man. Just give him a gun. Just shut up and stop complaining already. The Nemesis program is a tree thing, dude. I don't know what your problem is. We're combating carbon in the atmosphere, and you send us this weird mutated arm guy.
I know. That's why the ocean dried up, because the Nemesis program couldn't stop it. Because they were too busy dealing with this mutant fuck.
Oh, man.
Anyways, I have one last thing in this movie that I liked. I think that this movie, it is at its best when it is refusing to explain itself. And if I were to fix it, I would probably go through and like cut as much exposition as I thought I could get away with. Because a lot of the stuff they say about how the T-virus works, we don't actually need to know, because we've seen movies and we know how zombie viruses works. And a lot of the stuff about how evil Umbrella is, it's like, again, we've seen movies. But there is one really good line that I think they should keep in as sort of just an explanation of what's going on. And it's Alice asking the anti-corporate infiltrator guy about Umbrella. And she goes, what kind of research? And he goes, the illegal kind. And frankly, why do you need any more than that explaining what Umbrella's doing?
It's also the legal kind, but you know, we do all kinds here.
Yeah, they do everything from bioweapons research, which is not actually that big of a field because you can't actually use the shit, all the way through consumer electronics somehow. So they're like, if Amazon was twice the size and maybe 1.2 times as evil.
Yeah, not that much more evil.
Yeah. Anyways, what else got a part?
Reduce its evil density, but.
Yeah, and the overall evil is bigger, but it is less concentrated on an individual, like, per unit basis.
But then they reconcentrate it into a hive-like structure. Then it goes, like, you know, massive, super massive black hole style.
And distill it down into a virus.
Well, the virus the good guy in the Resident Evil movies, because it kills everyone.
It finally rids us of those pesky oceans.
Yeah, people seem to be pretty much the most evil thing in these movies. So, you know, who are you really rooting for here?
Anyways, anyone else got a parting shot?
I've got a one last low point.
Hit me.
That's the best actor in the movie is Jason Isaacs, and he has like one line, and they don't even show his face. So I was like, why did you guys get Jason Isaacs to do this one random line read?
I think he was supposed to come back for the sequel, but then he kind of doesn't. So Jason Isaacs' entire is probably the biggest movie star that's ever in this. And I think his entire contribution is showing up for one scene in a mask and then reading the opening narration for this in a bad American accent.
But still the best parts of the movie, so.
Oh, yeah. Anyways, so I guess I was going to do a little, like, getting to know you kind of question, which is what passes for games these days.
All right.
So let's see here. Okay. How would you describe your style? So I'm going to go first to give you guys some time to think. My style is based around mostly practicality and the fact that, for reasons I've not really figured out, I really like flannels. So I wear jeans or running pants or cargo shorts, depending on the weather. The jeans are, of course, my formal wear. So if I'm going out to meet people, I will wear the jeans. But if I'm just lounging around the house, it will be some of these like nicely insulated running pants that I enjoy because they let me run early in the morning and they're reasonably comfortable. And then for a shirt, a t-shirt, and then over that, some kind of flannel-based jacket. And it's a powerful aesthetic of just not giving a shit for a very long time. Ronald, how would you describe your style?
My style is just, it's like incomprehensibly sweet, obviously. I don't know, man. We've lived in a pandemic for like 3 years, so my style is like a hoodie and jeans. Like that's what I wear to the office. That's what I wear around the house. I
Ron maybe style is a more. Tech bro.
Yeah, I feel like I'm a tech bro in the sense that I wear a hoodie and jeans.
And you're only something of a hacker.
Yeah, and I work for a software company.
Hello, my name is Ronald. I am a hacker.
I am what you might call a hacker.
But I think aside from the fact that I work in software and that I wear a hoodie, I don't really think that I'm a tech bro, but if you're just looking at those two stats, like, I'm maxed out.
I mean, you have no toxic masculinity, but on the other hand, you work in tech and you're a dude, so.
Yeah, so. Ooh, yeah. By the definition of the name, yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, Brandon, what is your style?
It's the same. It's just jeans and a hoodie 99% of the time.
Another tech bro.
You can tell that Brandon is also in the software industry.
Obviously.
They literally don't let you wear a hoodie unless you know how to code. One time I forgot the algorithmic like complexity of accessing an element in an associative array. And you know what? They wouldn't let me wear a hoodie for 2 weeks.
Yeah, they cut the hood off.
Yeah. They're like, you have to earn this.
It's like cutting your top knot.
Yeah. Also, when you get serious, you have to put the hood on and, you know, put on your headphones and
yeah,
type really fast.
To stop the outside world from distracting you from your hacking.
Yeah. And tell people that you're jacked in.
Yeah. And Raul, what's your style?
My style is like one or two joggers that I wear continuously that are covered in cat hair.
Oh yeah.
That's an important part.
Yeah. It's an important accessory.
It's incredibly important. And a bunch of shirts that are basically a thrift store material at this point have a bunch of holes in them.
Yeah, you saw t-shirts from like middle school
that I constantly wear because I don't care at all anymore, apparently. So
Rahul's old look was like cargo shorts and t-shirt. That's what I still think of him like that.
You think he's the cargo shorts guy?
Yeah.
Like Napoleon Dynamite, but with shorts.
Is that the point that I might wear cargo pants?
Yeah, you wore cargo pants.
Okay, then sure.
You know, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think cargo pants might be a little too cool for Napoleon Dynamite.
He wore cargo pants. There was a scene where he was wearing cargo pants and he had tater tots or something in his pants.
That is something that I would have done to you.
I would never put that. That shit is too oily to put in your pants, bro. Like, that's crazy.
You know, I'm looking at them. These appear to be cargo sweatpants.
Huh.
What the fuck?
I like how much that enraged. Yeah. I think that Lawrence is only enraged because he wishes that he had
them. I think so. I think you nailed it. Lawrence is just overcome with jealousy right now.
I don't like the idea of a zippered pocket on a sweatpants. Zipper on sweat material just seems unholy to me.
What about for a pocket, though? It's a good idea.
Okay.
You have style opinions.
Well, yeah, now,
please tell us.
I mean, they're mostly about like very specific advice on what temperatures are appropriate for what tops when you're trying to run. It's a weird science because you need a lot less when you're running.
So when do you wear the silk, I guess, is my first question.
Yeah.
When you wear the cashmere. When I'm getting down to a business with, you know, my wife and a harem of babes. Sexual business? Are you trying to embarrass me by making it... Look, I don't want to say it. I'm a class dude.
You have sex with your wife, dude?
Look, a gentleman never tells.
Okay, wait. I have a follow-up question to your question. What was your style in middle school? Since we all knew each other in middle school. Our style in middle school was like vastly different. Like everyone just kind of dresses like pretty casually now, but you know, in middle school it was like we were trying to impress other people but also coming into our own.
So my style in middle school was a lot of polo shirts and then slightly dressy pants because I went to a school that sort of had a dress code and I was the only one who followed it. My style in high school is more interesting because there was a period in 11th grade when I wore sunglasses at all times and a fedora that I refused to take off because I thought these things made me cool. They did not.
So Lawrence was a finance bro in middle school. Yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, you made me cool because you were already cool, bro.
In high school, you were a fucking serial killer. So I'm not sure what aesthetic you were going for.
I mean, honestly, I wasn't, but...
Serial killer, finance bro.
Honestly.
He saw American Psycho and was like, that's my...
Yep, I kept doing all this workouts and skincare regimen and stuff. Feeding dogs to ATMs, etc. Yeah. Anyways, anyone else want to talk about their middle school style?
I don't remember my middle school style at all. It must have just been whatever was available or whatever I was bullied into wearing.
You were just wandering around the streets of Albuquerque looking at dumpsters for clothing you could wear.
Yeah, I don't remember middle school style at all. It must have been just random shit from, like, fucking wherever.
My middle school style was, like, ill-fitting, the most ill-fitting clothes in combinations that would basically confuse anyone who perceived upon me. I had a really weird middle school style. I was a very strange middle schooler. I remember one time I was walking up to the building and Brandon was talking with, they told me about this afterwards. Brandon was talking with another friend of ours, Josh, and they were like, oh, here comes Ronald. He's gonna say something stupid as soon as he walks in the door. And I opened the door and I'm like, dude, we're all wearing shorts. Because it was like the first day of the season where we were all wearing shorts. Classic. Middle school was not my best time. Let me put it that way.
Brandon, what was your middle school style?
I mean, I don't think I really had a style in middle school either. I think I just wore like shorts or jeans and I don't know, random t-shirts. Like I tried to develop like a goth style and then that didn't work.
Goth bro.
Tech bro, goth bro.
Yeah, goth bro.
You know, I remember actually thinking you were pretty well dressed in high school. I mean, I was a high schooler as well, so it's not hard to impress everyone, but I thought that your spiky hair and those pants you wore with the chains and that one Now in Zen t-shirt you had that said, by reading this, you have briefly given me control of your mind, were all pretty fucking sharp.
I think that you, of all of us, had the most developed sense of style. I think we were just wearing literally anything that we had in our...
We were all just, like, treading water, trying not to drown, and you were... standing on the
boat. He's doing fucking breaststroke over here.
I'd say being a tryhard is definitely a part of my personality, so I think that's out.
Which bro is that?
A try bro.
Political bro?
I don't know. Try bro, dude.
Try bro.
And that can also be the kind of bro who's way too into Zelda and always talking about the Triforce.
Yeah, it's two different spellings, but... Generally, they're about the same.
Homophones, bitch.
Yeah.
Anyways, let's get on to recommendations and cautions. Bring this boy home. What do you think?
Let's do it.
Okay. Brandon, would you like to go first?
I would not.
Okay. Ronald?
Fair enough. All right, I got some. All right.
You fucking better.
I've got a recommendation, and I've got a caution this week. My caution's going to cause some ripples, so let's save that for a second. Recommendation is this TV series on Netflix that just came out called The Night Agent. Now, it sounds generic, and you may watch the trailer and think, that looks generic. It is a little bit. It is a political thriller starring Gabriel Basso. Gabriel Basso, not a super well-known actor, but you might recognize him from Super 8. He's like the tall, nerdy kid. Which really freaked me out when I figured that out, because it's like, holy shit, it's been that long since Super 8 came out, because he's a full-ass adult in this. But it's basically about this guy who is working some weird hotline for the FBI and has to protect this woman who witnesses a murder, and there's a bunch of people within the agency and within the White House potentially that are trying to kill her or stop her from spreading anything she knows. And I really love political thrillers. I think this one was actually pretty solid. I didn't have that much hope for it going in, but after I watched an episode or two, I was like, wow, I'm actually pretty hooked into this. So I would definitely recommend The Night Agent if you're into those kinds of political thrillers, which is like still one of my favorite genres, even though it's filled with so many bad ones. I quite recommend The Night Agent. Now, my caution this week, I'm sorry to say, is John Wick Chapter 4.
Well, actually, you said it was controversial, and then I realized I don't care. So,
yeah, I mean, it's not that controversial, whatever. Who gives a shit what I say? Now, I love action movies, so this might seem kind of surprising. It's like it's definitely like kind of my thing, I would say, is action movies. So I've seen all of the John Wick movies. I quite liked the first one. And I felt this way about John Wick Chapter 3 as well. I still watched this movie because it had Scott Adkins in it. That was the main reason I went to go see it. I think he did a great job. His character was kind of not that important, but I still really liked him in it. But I just don't think that the movies have that much to say anymore. And, you know, I know that there are a lot of people out there who's like, that's not the point. It's just to see a bunch of stunts. And I mean, fair enough, but I actually am not that intrigued by the stunts that are happening in this movie. I think some of them are really cool, and there's definitely some good stuff that's going on, but I just get really bored after watching this for a while. Keanu Reeves is not Jackie Chan. He is not doing as nearly as interesting of stuff as Jackie Chan does in like Rumble in the Bronx, which you could argue is a very stupid movie that's just a ton of fight scenes back to back, but I love that movie. And I think that's because, one, it's more fun. It doesn't take itself nearly as seriously. And the fight scenes themselves are way better than anything in John Wick. You know, the gunfight scenes, maybe I just don't have enough appreciation for it. So I'll give it that. But, you know, I
agree. A movie can't just be fight scenes. There needs to be a reason for it.
There has to be something.
I feel like they just lost after John Wick 1, personally.
I agree. And I also think that, like, John Wick takes itself very seriously. This movie's like 3 hours long. It's way too long. Maybe if it was 90 minutes, I would have been fine with it. But so anyways, I personally don't recommend it. If you're interested, maybe, you know, you can go check it out and let me know what you think. But that's my caution for the week. And that's it for me.
I'm going to go next. So recommendation. This is, I think, the thing I recommended on the last episode, but I've recently been rereading part of it because I'm reading to Bianca. Some is sort of a way of spending pleasant time with her. And I still stand by it. This is Cunning Folk by Adam L.G. Neville. It is a horror novel about a man who buys a fixer-upper house in an English village that he can't quite afford. It's one of those, you know, if you squint, you can kind of and get some lucky breaks, you can make the finances work. But if anything goes wrong, you're fucked type deals. And he moves in with his wife and kids. And then he discovers that the neighbors next door are really don't like him, and furthermore that they have supernatural powers, and it builds beautifully. It's got this wonderfully escalating tension of just showing more and more what the neighbors can do and how fucked the guy is, and the climax of it is absolutely wild. And there is this one sequence in particular that breaks one of the fundamental rules of this kind of pop horror novel in a way that was like stunning to me. Like, I was out running and I had to pause for a moment because the thing that happened in the novel literally took my breath away. And I don't think I've ever experienced that in another book. So really, check this thing out. It is incredible. That is Cunning Folk by Adam L.G. Neville. And then for my caution, now this is a movie that Ronald recommended to me, although he said that he confused it with another movie. This is Never Back Down 2, The Beatdown, which is, I believe, from 2011 and directed by Michael Jai White. I fucking love Michael Jai White. It's a simple story of four twinks who get super into MMA to win some kind of not terribly well-defined underground tournament that seems to just be run by this one annoying guy. Like, a college student is somehow setting up an MMA match and like attracting thousands of people. It has Michael Jai White in a supporting character as the disgraced former MMA guy who trains the twinks in MMA. And there are a couple of amazing scenes of him like shirtless doing ultra pull-ups that are pretty cool. and two scenes where Michael Jai White is actually fighting that are really good. But the rest of it, the stunt people doing it are just not on the level of Michael Jai White, and they do okay with their action sequences, but not great. And a lot of it is given over to like kind of soapy college romances that aren't terribly well written, and I don't think would be interesting even if they were. So I would probably not watch this. Ronald has said that 3 is better, so I may watch that. Although 3 is also completely different because they just abandoned the Twinks entirely and followed Michael Jai White, which is what they should have done in the first place.
Okay, really quick, I want to interject. I forgot that there was more than 2 Never Back Downs. So I thought in my head, I combined the best parts of 2 and 3. That's what I recommended. Obviously, there was a 2 and a 3. So I don't necessarily know that the individual movies are that good. But, you know, there's some pretty good fight scenes in the third one, too.
There is one absolutely incredible sequence in the second one where Michael Jai White is handcuffed and some cops are trying to beat him, and he just somehow takes them down without ever once using his hands. That's pretty good. Although that, I mean, he is, you know, an African-American man, and they videotape him beating up all the cops and then act like the videotape is somehow going to stop him from getting in trouble. And it's like, no, that's going to get him executed, dudes. Yeah. Anyways. Yeah. Brandon, would you like to go now or still in pass?
Sure. I'll go. I'm just going to give a recommendation that I think I gave on the Prometheus episode again, which is the movie Barbarian, which is a horror movie. It starts out with a girl arriving really late at night at an Airbnb, and she can't remember the code to unlock the key lock box. Then when she finally does, it's empty, and she realizes that there's someone in the house already, and he answers the door, and there's some confusion about it. He thinks he booked it and she thinks she booked it, but it all feels kind of sketchy, like maybe this is a trap or something, but she doesn't have anywhere else to go. She can't book anything else. And the person who's already in the house, by the way, is Bill Skarsgård, which makes it really awesome and a little bit extra creepy. And he's trying to be really nice and like kind of overly nice and inviting about the whole thing. He lets her take the bedroom and he's going to sleep on the couch. In the middle of the night, she closes and locks her bedroom door when she does finally agree to stay. In the middle of the night, like, it's open and she freaks out. But then nothing ends up happening that night. When in the morning, she realizes that like she's in like a super shitty part of Detroit. And like, this is the only nice house on the entire block. And there's no lights on the block, which is why she didn't see this in the middle of the night. And then a bunch of weird stuff, like she's there for a few days. And so weird stuff starts to build up around the house, and like whether it's Bill Skarsgård doing this or whether he's also like innocent and getting preyed upon or what's happening. And yeah, I think it develops really, really well. It's very creepy. The actual sort of twist slash like the explanation at the end is kind of weird and silly, but I think everything else is really good.
I would 2 things about that movie. First, it also has Justin Long in probably his funniest role.
Yeah,
which is kind of astonishing, like, because he's just playing this absolute bastard who keeps finding like new and interesting ways of being a bastard. And 2, this movie actually taught me something very useful, which is one of the things I used to try to do when I was trying to like make especially women feel more at home is just point out to them like, you know, hey, I have left the key in the door so that, you know, you can get out if you need to, stuff like that. And this movie showed me that that is actually an incredibly upsetting thing to do. And I shouldn't be doing that.
Like, oh my God, how long have I been doing this? Why didn't anybody tell me?
Yeah. Also, fun fact about that movie, it's directed by Zach Kreger of Whitest Kids You Know fame.
Yeah.
What?
It's really weird, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Anyways, and finally, do you have a caution?
I don't have a caution.
I apologize for cutting you off, though. Rahul, fuck. Too many R names in here.
I have no recommends or cautions.
Okay, do you have a plug?
I like to plug Simeon Stylites. You heard of this old boy?
No, that's not what I expected you to plug.
Yeah, that's not what I expected you to plug at all.
According to Theodoret, Simeon developed zeal for Christianity at the age of 13, following a reading of the Beatitudes. He entered a monastery before the age of 16. From the first, he gave himself up to the practice of an austerity so extreme and to all appearance so extravagant that his brethren judged him to be unsuited to any form of community life. They asked Simeon to leave the monastery.
What the fuck? That's like hashtag goals, bro. That's
so good. So he was like fasting so hard it was making the other monks uncomfortable.
So he kept trying to get away from people and like do crazy feats of austerity. So he started to live on top of pillars, and more people came to like bother him. So he just kept moving to taller and taller pillars. And he was like the original influencer, you know? Like people kept coming up to this guy on his fucking pillar.
Like, look, the guy on the pillar. He's like,
and he's like, he literally leave me alone. On the pillar.
Look, I just want to be on this pillar and be left alone. I don't know why you guys keep bothering me.
How
do you eat? For sustenance, small boys from the nearby village would climb up the pillar and pass him parcels of flat bread and goat's milk.
A parcel of goat's milk.
Parcels of flat bread and goat's milk.
Fascinating. Now, Rahul, may I ask a question? How the fuck? What were you doing where you found this weird monk who lived on pillars?
Don't know. I couldn't tell
like,
you,
man. He was like, can I live on a pillar? And he found, he did that and he found Simeon stylized. And he was like, yes.
I don't know how I was linked to him, but I read his Wikipedia and I was like, this fool was kicked out of his monastery for being too extreme in his austerity. And I thought that was beautiful and amazing. So I had to plug this old boy.
One day you will get there.
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to plug?
No, that's it.
Okay, I really thought that one picture of the murderer's girlfriend was going to make an appearance.
Oh, yeah. You know, I felt like I'm not going to plug that one. I'm going to keep that.
Yeah, you're going to keep that in your back pocket.
Yeah, that one's important to me, and I don't want to share it with anybody.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. I guess, readers, that'll just be a fun little mystery to you. Our group chat has been extremely strange these last couple of days.
Yeah. I want to say that I didn't start any of it.
What?
I was just drawn up into events that Ronald probably put Lawrence up to something, and it somehow sucked me into a whirlpool of whatever is going on.
Yeah, that's what happened. Yeah. Anyways, from all of us at Bad Time Radio, I consider living on a pillar, but it might not be for you, but definitely don't worship Satan because it is bad for you. Signing off.
If you'd like to recommend an episode of Old Time Radio for us to listen to, send us a question for the mailbag, or a pedantic correction, you can reach us at radiobadtime@gmail.com. Our theme music is Finger in the Bottle by We Ashore Dedicated off their album No Ski Here Okie Sap. Thanks so much for listening.
Well, I was gonna get rich. Finger in the bottle. Now feel the head swish. Cross my bare bones.